the real winners and losers of the Maine State Lottery. Americans love to gamble. We spend more money each year on the lottery than on sports, books, movies, video games, and music combined. And states like Maine that have run lotteries for four decades have been major beneficiaries to the tune of over $1 billion to the general fund since 1974. But critics of this form of gambling say it targets those least able to afford it. A study out of Cornell found that of the 10 Maine towns whose residents spend the most on lottery tickets, six are among the state's poorest. In Waite, Maine, lotteries took in more than $1,300 for every man, woman, and child in 2014. I'm Keith Shortall. Today we'll talk with an editor, an historian, and a social scientist about the real winners and losers of the lottery. First, this news. From the MVBN studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. Today you see them at just about every convenience store and gas station. Scratch-off and Powerball lottery tickets. Some cost only a buck, others as much as $25. Prizes range from winning your money back to millions of dollars. Today we're going to discuss who plays the lottery and why, and where the money the lottery generates ends up. With me in the studio, John Christie. He's editor of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. On the line with us from Cornell University is David Just. He's a professor of and director of graduate studies in the Charles H. Dyson School of Applied Economics and Management at Cornell University. And thank you both for joining us today. Appreciate that. And of course, we want to hear from you as well. Do you play the lottery? Do you know what happens to the proceeds from the Maine lottery? Our phone number here is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Email address, talk@mpbn.net. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Excuse me. Before I turn to my two guests today, though, we're going to get a little history of the origins of the lottery in the U.S. from author Kevin Flynn. He's written a new book called American Sweepstakes, How One Small State Bucked the Church, the Feds, and the Mob to Usher in the Lottery Age. He joins us from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio. Kevin Flynn, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Keith.
Lottery is not a new thing. It's been around for centuries, actually, and was quite active in the United States, even in the formative years of the nation, but then fell out of favor with the feds. How did we get the lottery as we know it today started here in the U.S.?
The first legal state-run lottery was in New Hampshire in 1964. Now, as you said, lotteries were ubiquitous in both colonial America and in the early part of the U.S. As you've heard before, people considered lotteries to be a, quote, painless way of raising money without taxation. Jamestown Colony was financed through a lottery. So you could say America is the offspring of a lottery. Washington's Continental Army was in part financed by a lottery. The expansion of Washington, D.C. in the 1820s was financed by a lottery. And it wasn't until after the Civil War when Louisiana created a lottery that was run by a third party. And this third party company, the Louisiana Lottery Company, was the largest and the most corrupt of the lottery operations. Now, all of these past lotteries were sanctioned by state legislatures, but they were always outsourced to third parties to do the business. So there were often brokers that would skim, would destroy tickets, find a way for politicians who backed them to miraculously know what the winning numbers were. And so there were anti-lottery legislation on the books by 1890 in order to clamp down on the corruption of lotteries.
And so it's
that brings us to 1960.
Yeah, I was going to say. It stays dormant, out of favor with the federal government for decades. Then, as you say, something happens here in the early 1960s, and it happens in New Hampshire.
Yes, the first state-run lottery is approved in the New Hampshire legislature. It is a sweepstakes, which is a two-part lottery. People would purchase tickets, and if their name was pulled, they would be matched with a thoroughbred racehorse who would run in a race. And so if that horse won the race, then the person or the people who are matched with that horse would win the jackpot. So it's a little different than the modern lottery that we know. However, this was the first time that a state took it upon itself to run a lottery. And their goal was, of course, to raise money. This money would be put towards education, and it would be different in the way that, of course, that now we have state officials who are running it, who are trying, you know, whose presence is supposed to eliminate the specter of corruption and racketeering. But it was not popular at first with everybody. Virtually every newspaper writer, editorialist was against it. The Saturday Evening Post, Reader's Digest. The paper in Lewiston had some very vicious editorials about what was going on in New Hampshire. But at the same time, it was a national scandal. It was a national sensation. And tens of thousands of people went to New Hampshire to buy tickets. And as you said, this was not popular with the federal government. They had some very strong anti-racketeering laws on the books about gambling paraphernalia crossing state lines. This was Bobby Kennedy's, you know, shot at the mob and the way they raise money. And the Justice Department said these laws applied to New Hampshire, that people could not take these sweepstakes tickets out of the state. And if they did, they would be breaking federal law. And there were people in the U.S. who were arrested and charged because they were in possession of a lottery ticket. And if we were having this discussion on the radio in 1964, the FCC would step in and say that you and I would be fined $1,000 for talking about lotteries.
So, but Amira, 10 years later, by the early 70s, a number of states in New England, including Maine, are well into their lottery experiences or starting their lottery experiences. What made the change?
Well, as you know, New Hampshire sort of led the way, and the sky didn't fall, and money was made. Other states looked upon this experiment with envious eyes. New York followed, then New Jersey followed, and they moved away from this complicated sweepstakes model to something more straightforward, a numbers draw. Then scratch tickets were developed by the Massachusetts Lottery in 1973, and this is when we start to see the lottery as we know it today. And then states just followed, and so did the money.
I read somewhere that someone said that the reason that New England in particular had taken to the lottery, or that it was accepted so readily in the 70s, was that there were a lot of Catholics who were used to this type of gambling, that lotteries were popular. Did you find that at all?
Oh, I didn't see a correlation between religious background and whether or not people would play the lottery. Yeah, I mean, Catholics did bingo. I can tell you today, I'm helping my daughter get through Catholic school by volunteering for bingo. So, I guess that's still part of it. I will say that, that people have gambled forever, and the lottery is not an original sin. Before the lottery was in place, just about anybody in any neighborhood could place a bet with a bookie, because virtually everybody knew somebody who ran the numbers. And the difference between the pre-lottery gamblers and the lottery age gamblers is that, you know, if you were betting with a bookie, you didn't know if the numbers game was on the level, because a lot of them weren't. And that bookie, you know, could come to your house as a convenience to take your numbers, but they also came when you needed to pay up. And that wasn't always great. So it was either going from, you know, betting a couple of coins or a couple of bucks with the neighborhood bookie, or now, you know, it moved over to the state that's running the same kind of numbers games.
Yeah, and many states are, and are the beneficiaries of that. Kevin, thanks very much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Keith.
Kevin Flynn is the author of the new book, American Sweepstakes: How One Small State bucked the church, the feds, and the mob to usher in the lottery age. You're listening to Maine Calling. John Christie, you wanted to comment.
If Kevin's still on the line, I guess he isn't, because I did have a question, and I the question I had.
I'm here.
Oh, good. Kevin, this is John Christie. Is the main reason, the primary reason for restoring the lotteries in the state, started with New Hampshire, and then I think Massachusetts was pretty soon afterwards in New York. Was it a revenue enhancement program? Was it a way to raise more revenue without raising taxes?
I can tell you that in New Hampshire, yes, it was. It came down legislatively to either you were in favor of the sweepstakes or you were in favor of a sales tax, which is, you know, in New Hampshire, we still don't have a sales tax or an income tax. So that was a very powerful argument. I think that the reason actually for decades, other states had sort of dabbled in lotteries and sweepstakes and putting forth legislations. And in Massachusetts, there was a referendum in the late 50s that was a popular vote. People wanted a lottery or sweepstake, but lawmakers never passed them. So I think at first it was here in New Hampshire, we could say it was sweepstakes or sales tax. I think after that, it was probably more driven by, look, there's a market that we can tap into, and we don't necessarily need to implement a new tax or raise taxes. But a lot of times, as you know, if that money is not dedicated for a specific purpose, like in New Hampshire, this education fund, it goes on the pile.
Yeah. And John Christie, we'll reintroduce you here to those who may be just be joining us. You're editor at the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting, which ran a series recently on the lottery. And the takeaway there, I guess, is really looking at where the money goes. And maybe the premise, if you will, though, is that is looking at how this connection between the per capita sale of lottery tickets in Maine, there's this very close connection to poverty levels.
Yes, the author of the story was Dave Sherwood, when I work with Dave, and David Just, who's going to be on soon, too, on the research in this story. And quickly to answer your question, where does the money go? The money in Maine goes on the pile. It goes in the general fund. It is not dedicated to any particular purpose, as it is in other states. And there have been three or four attempts in Maine to dedicate it to education, to fighting hunger, to gambling addiction, but they all fail in the legislature because, as one of the people we interviewed said, we're addicted to this revenue source, which after all the bills are paid and people got their winnings, about $50 million a year goes to the state revenue, and it's been about over the course of the history of the lottery about $1 billion. But I think what we wanted to find out is to go back to the foundational questions that were raised about the Maine lottery. Why do we have one? Who's using this lottery? What is it? What's its effect on us? Even going back to a fundamental question, the state constitution says the state exists for the common welfare. Is a common welfare being provided for by something like a state-run gambling system? And we found out with David's help here that the most likely person to buy a lottery ticket is the least likely person to afford it. And people are spending not just $1 here or there, but we have anecdotal evidence beyond the statistical evidence that shows that people will even come to the lottery, to their cash register with the lottery tickets and the groceries. In one case, someone said there wasn't enough to pay for all of it, and the woman put her milk back and bought the lottery ticket. So the poorest towns in Maine are the most likely to spend the most money. Maine's poorest towns spend as much as 200 times more per person than those in wealthier sections of the state.
David Just, let's bring you in here. You were asked to look at this. You're a researcher at Cornell University, and the center asked you to look at Maine and look at you're the source of some of these statistics that John's talking about here. Is it safe to say that what you found is consistent with studies done in other parts of the country? That is this link between sort of the desperation buying of tickets to get out of poverty as opposed to just having fun and spending a few dollars to see if you win a few dollars?
It is consistent with that. It's hard when you deal with aggregate data to really ferret out desperation versus maybe just cheap entertainment. And that's actually one of the ways the lottery sells itself is trying to say, no, this isn't desperation. They're not making an investment. this is how they have fun. This is how, you know, they do this instead of going to the movies because the movies are more expensive in many cases. But you do find pretty consistently that there's a much higher percentage of low-income folks who are playing the lottery, and they're spending a higher percentage of their money on the lottery.
You found, for example, that of the top 10 communities where the per capita spending on lottery was highest, coincided also with some of the poorest communities?
Yes. You find that in Maine. You find that in a lot of different states where the data is available, that really that's where the lottery becomes popular. That's where they get traction and they get sales.
Yeah. These are statistical comparisons, that is, they overlap. But is there any research that goes and, you know, tries to ask these people who are buying lottery tickets at amounts they can't afford why they're doing it? Or are we basically looking at the poverty rate, the ticket sales, and making conclusions about that ourselves?
The data we've used in Maine, and I'd say sort of the typical study, also looks essentially just at the correlations between poverty or you know, other sorts of measures of misery, if you will, and lottery play. But there have been some studies that looked very directly at why people buy. We had a study we did about a decade ago where we very closely modeled and looked at how people buy lottery tickets to see if it behaved the way other sorts of entertainment does, and it doesn't. You do start playing the lottery more when you find yourself in a desperate circumstance, and you don't do that with entertainment. You don't have the time for more entertainment when you're facing desperation. They really do seem to be sort of using this as the Hail Mary, if you will.
Sure. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your questions and comments. The number again is 800-399-3566. We're talking about the lottery. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Casella. Committed to safe, efficient disposal of non-recyclable waste for all 16 Maine counties. Casella, giving resources new life.
Next time on Living on Earth, talking turkey ahead of Thanksgiving and the pluses and minuses of buying a heritage bird.
The heritage ones are, well, they look like they don't have that big a breast. You know, they're a little leaner, slimmer birds.
But some people swear that what is there tastes better and will pay more. I'm Steve Kerwood, and that's next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
Join us for Living on Earth Sunday morning at 7 o'clock here on MPBN. This Day in Maine is available online at mpbn.net. You can stream it whenever you want or take it as a podcast. What is it? This Day in Maine is the day's collection of all the Maine news reporting by the MPBN news staff, hosted each evening by MPBN's Barbara Caridi. This Day in Maine is available online each weeknight by 7 o'clock. Listen to it then, later, the next morning, on the way to work. If Maine is on your mind, This Day in Maine will keep you up to date.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, The Lottery in Maine. With me in studio, John Christie. He's editor at the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. On the line with us is David Just. He's professor of behavioral economics at Cornell University. And we invite you, as always, to join the conversation. The number is 800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Email talk at mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. On the line with us also now is Louis Lucchini. He represents Ellsworth in the Maine House, a Maine State House. He's chair of the Veterans and Legal Affairs Committee, which oversees lottery operations. Representative Lucchini, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
So I guess this is leading to our next question here, which is, oversight of lottery operations. It's somewhat independent, but there is some oversight. How rigorous is oversight of the lottery operations in Maine?
Well, I think oversight of the lottery is something that we're really going to have to examine closely this session. I think just fundamentally, if we're going to conduct the lottery, it's essential that we do have strong oversight. And looking over the legislative history and the lottery statutes, you know, the legislature created the Liquor and Lottery Commission, you know, for that purpose of oversight. And so, you know, we want to make sure that they're actually doing, you know, a really strong job of overseeing the lottery. And it's made up of public members who are supposed to be a check and a balance on, you know, a government-run business.
Yeah. We did invite representatives from the commission to come on. They declined. What are your concerns about how the lottery, if any, about how the lottery runs, advertises? What are the issues, as you see it, that need a second look?
Well, you know, there's a lot of issues, and I think the article that was published, you know, really raised a lot of great questions, and Professor Just's research is really eye-opening. But I think one of the biggest questions that I've heard from my colleagues is, you know, whether or not we're intentionally directing, I guess, ad revenue towards the poorer communities. And, you know, we don't know that. The article wasn't able to determine that. But I think we really want to look hard and make sure that we're not doing that, because all the legislators I've spoken to, you know, have said that if we were intentionally directing our advertising at the poorer communities in Maine, then there would be a big problem, and something that we'd have to fix, you know, this session.
Yeah. Now, this issue, the lottery, the commission, how it's run, the system has been under, or there'd been an attempt to do a legislative scrutiny under the Government Oversight Committee a few years ago.
Right. Yeah. And my understanding is that the OPEGA group is, you know, just very busy, and they have to kind of prioritize based on what the Government Oversight Committee wants to do. But, you know, I think going forward, it'd be great to have them take a look at the oversight the commission provides. When you take a look in the rules, you know, really the statutes aren't very extensive for the lottery, but gives a lot of power to the commission to take an active role in promulgating rules, policies for the agency to follow. You know, they're supposed to meet not less than once a month with the director. And so recently, one of the areas I've really been trying to research is to see, you know, what the commission does at its meetings. And, you know, I've requested the minutes from the meetings to date. Still haven't gotten them, but I hope that we can get them soon and see what the topics discussed are, and, you know, just to make sure that they are, you know, really thinking hard before they make these decisions on advertising.
Do you believe the lottery is a de facto tax on the poor?
You know, I think it can be seen as a tax, sure.
And my final question to you is, have you ever played the lottery? Do you play the lottery? Scratch tickets, anything?
No, I don't. I'm not a big fan of the lottery playing wise. No, I know pretty well that the odds are not in my favor.
All right.
I'm not a big gambler.
All right. Representative Lucchini, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Louis Lucchini represents Ellsworth in the Maine State House and is chair of the Veterans Affairs Committee, which oversees lottery operations here in Maine. Let me ask you, John Christie, have you ever done a scratch ticket, bought a lottery ticket when it was above $3 million?
I was in Massachusetts working there as a reporter when it began. I know we used to put in a buck each at the newsroom for about a month or two, and then stopped doing it. So, I mean, it's a little bit of fun if people can afford it. I mean, I don't think anybody would really object to that. But what I found interesting in our research was that when the lottery began in 73, after a couple of years, they realized that they weren't making the kind of money they thought they should be making. It wasn't coming in at the rate they thought, especially from certain parts of the state. And that's when the pressure came on to begin to advertise heavily and to get the numbers up. So Maine is on their own. We're a rather flinty group, or at least historically we were, from northern New England. You know, it's only spent a moderate amount of money on the lottery and probably approached it somewhat frugally, which is our history. But that wasn't sufficient for the state, who had some money that they want, a number they wanted to bring in revenue. And so the advertising began, has only escalated since then to the point it's $3.5 million a year. And the latest advertising campaigns are meant to equate buying a lottery ticket with going to the movies or going to a Patriots game, so that it takes the onus off the idea of it being gambling. It's not going to be gambling. It's entertainment. But, of course, it is gambling. As the representative said, hey, the odds aren't very good. when you go and buy a movie ticket for $14, you get to see a movie. When you buy $14 with the lottery tickets, you don't get anything but this daydream, which Kevin talks about, this hope that you may do something that isn't going to materialize except in the rarest of cases.
David, just is there, are there data or information from studies that indicate that these folks who can ill afford to play the lottery may not understand the long odds that they face on even a scratch ticket?
Well, so I think if you sat them down and you talked them through it, they would acknowledge it. But at a gut level, when people are making these decisions, they don't necessarily access that information, right? And what we find, and this is true with just about everybody, is when we start to face some sort of scarcity, we face some sort of desperate situation, the amount of bandwidth we have, you know, to make decisions, the amount of, you know, just brain resources to make those decisions goes away. And we stop thinking about those things. We just stop paying attention to the long odds, and it becomes this symbol of hope, this, you know, this is my way out. This is how I'm going to be able to do it. And yes, there has been evidence that really does impact people's ability to make decisions and figure out how they deal with long odds, if you will.
All right, let's go to the phones. We'll bring in Belinda in Bangor. Hi, Belinda.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Okay, I have two just brief comments that I wanted to make, because I am a very, very working class citizen, and I have a fairly low income. I play the lottery on occasion. I'm not a math genius, and, you know, I really struggle. But I play the lottery on occasion because I'd like to win. I know that the odds are very terrible. I know that there's not much of a chance that I'd even get my $2 back. But everybody wants to win something at one time or another. And at one time or another, everybody feels lucky for a moment or for a day or whatever. But I think that people like me, we just do it because wouldn't it be wonderful to win something, whether it be a lot or a little bit? It makes you feel good. I think that it's really a shame that the lottery isn't made more accessible in winning to more people. I think that it would be a lot more fun to play, a lot less dangerous to play, if more people had a chance to win. There's a lot of money in the lottery coffers, and I'd like to see it spread out more. And I really believe that most people, not all people, play the lottery either weekly or occasionally, just because we would feel so good if we just won a little something.
And is that okay with you, John Christie?
No, you can't really object to that hope and feeling in people's minds. And it's like any sort of pleasure you have. If you don't abuse it, then it's not necessarily a problem. I think the ethical question that we tried to raise and others have raised is this the business of the state to do this? To promote and be the carnival barker and to offer you hope that we understand is fun to daydream about, but is not very realistic. What do other many things offer us that? But this is the only thing that the state, our tax money, everybody's tax money, goes into an agency that then spends $3.5 million of that tax money to persuade you to buy something you wouldn't normally buy. Is that the proper role of our government?
Defenders, of course, would say, and you've heard this, that as we've mentioned, $1.19 billion to the general fund since 1974, and $320 million in sales commissions and bonuses to the retailers who sell the tickets. So that would be part of the response.
That's why probably nothing's going to change, because the state wants this money. If more money was given to prizes, as Belinda suggested, instead of $50 million going to the state, it maybe would be $25 million, and the state would not be very happy with cutting its revenue by a half.
And Representative Lucchini, is that part of the problem, that nobody wants this to go away, even the people who are losing a lot of money every day and can't afford it?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that's part of the problem. A lot of people like the lottery and just play it for fun and want to have that chance to win and are responsible about it. But, you know, you have to take into account the people who misuse it, and just whether or not, as John was saying, it's appropriate for the state to be pushing people into it.
Let's go to Carol in Starks. Hi, Carol.
Hi. Thank you for doing this study. I really am very impressed by having read all of the pieces of the puzzle. And I'm just wondering if anyone has any proposed solutions. I noticed that I used to work in the field of tobacco, especially in secondhand smoke for the state of Maine, and our statistics show that those who can least afford to buy tobacco products are those most likely to buy. And I'm seeing this as reflecting the same population disparity. And I'm just wondering if there's any way for better oversight of the program. I think one of the things that came out of the many articles was that there's very limited oversight of this committee. So I'm just interested in what John Christie and others might think of that. Thank you.
Sure. Let's bring in David Just first here. On a national level, are you aware of proposed solutions that get at the findings of some of this research around the connection or the connection between poverty and lottery use?
There hasn't been much proposed that I guess I would classify as effective. There's almost all state lotteries have some portion of their money that goes into, you know, treating those who with gambling addictions and other things like that, and they pay, you know, their advertising will include statements about avoiding gambling irresponsibly and things like that. But there's nothing directly that is looking at, you know, how do we curb play by those who really can't afford it, and where we might actually be doing some harm that we're not recognizing, you know, because we're supporting some people in the lower income ranges in terms of their food assistance and other things like that. They're trading off with lottery tickets.
Yeah, John Christie, do we run the risk of being patronizing to this population that says, yeah, I may not have a lot of money, but if I want to do this, it's my business?
I think if you looked at it that way, possibly. But the advertising, I think, is the other side of that view. We're not just saying play the lottery if you feel like it. We're saying advertising is a hidden persuader. We're persuading someone to do something they would normally want to do. And as far as Carol's question on oversight goes, since 2007, the legislature had had on its list to have its accountability organization, known as OPEGA, to look at the lottery. And every year, things more exciting, things more dramatic, things more political in some cases perhaps, get sent to that committee by the legislative committee that oversees OPEGA. And the lottery keeps being put off because I think we've neglected this topic because we don't want to look at it because it's a tough one.
Yeah. Let's take we're up against break, but I want to take one more call. We'll go to Peter in Trenton. Hi, Peter.
Hello. I was in a local convenience store a few days ago, and a man came in laid out about $50 on many lottery tickets, more than 20 of them. I can't remember just what they were. And every time he bought one, a recorded voice said, "You're a winner!" And he never won. If there was any truth in what that advertising was, it would say, "You're a loser!" But I asked him why he was doing that, and he said, "Well, you can't win if you don't play." I said, "But do you ever win?" He said, "Well, no, not yet, but I might." I thought, this is really false advertising, and there ought to be some laws brought to bear on that to entice people unrealistically with false promises of something that isn't going to happen. Why is the state, they wouldn't allow a company to do that. Why is the state able to do it?
All right. We'll answer your question and provide all the other answers to this complicated problem in the next 20 minutes. But first, we'll take a short break. When we come back, we want to hear from you as well. The number 800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Finance Authority of Maine, committed to expanding business and education opportunities by investing in Mainer's success. FameMaine.com. By Sillies and Sillies with a Twist in Portland's East End. Open at 11 Wednesday through Friday, 9 on the weekends, with vegan and gluten-free options. Sillies.com. And Abbey Museum, celebrating Native American Month with free admission to the Coming Home exhibit. AbbeyMuseum.org.
Intelligence Squared US, Oxford-style debating on American shores.
Enhancing our brains is a social good worth pursuing, and a social good we pursue all the time.
There are things we don't know about these drugs, and if there's actually nothing panning out in terms of benefits, it's not worth the risk.
the next topic up for debate, should college students be allowed to take smart drugs?
This afternoon at 1 o'clock.
The Clinton administration cracked down on so-called deadbeat dads and made progress. Now the White House says the system is stuck.
When people have orders that they can't comply with, it doesn't motivate them to work and pay. It does the opposite.
Fixing Child Support, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered coming up at 4 o'clock this afternoon on MPBN Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, a look at the lottery. Who plays it? Where the revenues go? Who are the winners and the losers? In the studio with me, John Christie. He's editor at the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. On the line with us, David Just. He's a professor of behavioral economics at Cornell University. And we invite you to join the conversation as well. The number is 1-800-399-3566. A caller heard me mention, David Just, that the of the top 10 poorest communities, or rather of the top 10 communities where the per capita spending for lottery was highest, six were among those that were among the poorest. I think some of those are in Washington County. But do you have the? I don't have the list in front of me of the top 10 towns. Do you have that, John, or David?
I have. If David doesn't, yes.
I don't. So go ahead,
yes,
John.
Okay. Well, from the highest spending of the 10 to the lowest, it's Waite, Columbia, West Forks, Vanceboro, Pembroke, Princeton, and those are the Torah towns. Then Agonquit, Perry, Vinyl Haven, and Randolph. And the towns where the least money is spent are Dayton, Cape Elizabeth, Hebron, Cushing, Wayne, North Yarmouth, Harpswell, South Bristol, Casco, and Kennebunkport, where it's interesting in David Sherwood's research found out that there was a community store in Kennebunkport that stopped selling lottery tickets because nobody was buying them.
I think it's in Kennebunkport, it's $6 per person.
Yeah, $6 per person, right.
As compared to
$1,300 in weight, yeah.
let's go to Bill in Belfast. Hi, Bill. Hi, Bill. Are you there?
I am. Thank you.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Yeah, two quick questions. There's some economists on the call. So how do the odds and cost of winning a month's worth of groceries compare to the odds and cost of getting to a position of financial security in some of these most rural, low-income towns? That's the first question.
Do you want to do one at a time there? David Just, did you want to tackle that?
Sure. Well, I mean, so off the top of my head, I couldn't cite the statistics on those. But, essentially, you put yourself in the position of that woman in the line debating her lottery ticket or her milk. And, the milk is going to be more valuable almost certainly, right? Because you have, your kids are going to be getting calcium and nutrients out of this. And that lottery ticket is almost completely certain is never going to give you a thing. But at the same time, how do you tell somebody to give up their hope, right? I mean, that's what that lottery ticket represents. They're falling prey to some pretty common biases in the way we think about risks that allow them to essentially dream that they're going to have the lottery pay off when it's not going to happen. And that's where the problem lies.
So, and also, I'll let you ask your second question in a moment here, Bill. But during the break, I pulled out some scratch tickets. I gave one to John, and I did one myself. This was the dollar scratch ticket, and I won a dollar. So I broke even. David, just is that just enough to keep me going? In other words, and another caller mentioned this too. She wished that there were more payouts. This is carefully designed so that if I get a little reward here, I get my dollar back or $2, that keeps me going, right? If I kept losing all the time, I might give up after a while.
Yeah. So the scratch lotteries actually end up being popular with really a different set than the draw lotteries. And the poorest of the poor are the most drawn to that draw lottery because it's the huge payout even if it's an astronomically low probability. Those draw lotteries are really designed exactly as you say. The way to design psychological reward systems so that people get addicted to things, so people really are the most motivated to do something, is a random reward. And so you have to have some small reward that pops up randomly and makes you think, you know, you keep playing and something's going to happen. And that's how it works. That's how the scratch lotteries get you to play more often.
Yeah. Bill, you had another question?
Yeah, real short. But if people are concerned about government involvement, truth in advertising, has anyone ever thought about taking some of the lottery receipts that go into the general fund and creating a trust, which then creates a scholarship fund that then people could essentially win on a lottery? Is that possible?
Representative Lucchini, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. Did you hear the question?
I did. Yeah. I think over the years there have been a few different proposals to try to, I guess, earmark some of the lottery's winnings to certain parts of, I guess, priorities, like whether it's education or something. But to date, really nothing has happened, and the money currently just goes to the general fund in a transfer.
Yeah. Since 1995, there have been a number of attempts to do that. One was for school funding. One was to reduce hunger in Maine. One was to create school scholarships. One was to pay for quality early child care education. And one was to benefit breast cancer education. All of those attempts to dedicate lottery monies to any one of those categories failed.
All right, let's go to Dick in Gouldsboro. Hi, Dick.
Hi there.
Hi there.
I had an interesting observation I made years ago, and that is, from doing a lot of reading, that it seems that the people who win big, and I mean, you know, up in the million-dollar range, after a year or two, wish they hadn't. They discover that making a huge amount of money suddenly creates endless problems, and especially with family and friends. I just found it very interesting that people buy more tickets when the pot is huge and less when it's not. And if they win, they're probably going to end up very unhappy.
Yeah, David Just, I know some work has been done on this. Be careful what you wish for or the difficulties of being a multimillionaire.
Yeah, the work on this is actually really fascinating. And it's pretty clear you find that there's an increased probability of bankruptcy after winning the lottery, winning a big jackpot. But the piece of work that's absolutely fascinating to me is one that sort of compared, you know, people's rating of their life, how happy they were about a year out, for lottery winners versus, believe it or not, quadriplegics, people who had just recently become quadriplegics. About a year out, the quadriplegics are a little bit happier than those who won the lottery about a year ago. And a lot of that is because when you win the lottery, you think all of your problems are just about to disappear, and you don't realize that really money doesn't address most of those problems that you have.
Troy writes to us on Facebook, before I was born, my parents spent their last dollar on a ticket in 1973 and won. I might not be around if my parents didn't have that kickstart to their finances. Nothing you all will say will dissuade me from playing because I enjoy it and it doesn't really harm me at all. So, congratulations to Troy. But I guess, John, you would say, again, that's not your...
Yeah, I have an anecdote. When I worked at a paper in Florida, one of the people on my staff won $1 million. And he then had to go into a sanatorium for a while. It overwhelmed him. He couldn't deal with it for a while. And afterwards, he was better. He did well with it. I'm sure winning a lot of money, if you handle it right and it's not too much that you can't deal with, is fine for people. It's just that the odds are very, very, very slim. If you buy one ticket in your lifetime and you hit the jackpot, I guess, you know, you've done well, but that's not the typical story. I'm always fascinated by my friends who are well-educated and don't take crazy risks, who, when there's a $100 million lottery ticket available in the tri-state, will get a ticket, but won't for the $50 million. And I ask them, why isn't $50 million worth your trouble, but $100 million is? Maybe David could explain, people don't really use their heads really well, even educated people, when it comes to this kind of money.
Well, I'm one of those people. I'm one of those people because... and I don't think, you know, honestly, I don't think I want $300 million or $100 million. I don't, you know, what would you do? I don't know what you would do. And you're absolutely right. But David, what is the phenomenon there that people will spend their dollar that they otherwise wouldn't risk on $50 million?
Yeah, so part of what happens is when the lottery jackpot gets larger, they start to advertise it more. They start to talk about it in the news day by day, and it becomes something that's just more available to you in your environment. And so you sort of get into it as somewhat of a social norm. The funny thing here is actually the jackpots now and again do get up large enough that it actually pays to play. That's a really strange thing to say, but you can have large enough jackpots that you'll have an average payout that's larger than the cost. It's just rare.
All right, let's go to Jake in Ellsworth. Hi, Jake.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Thank you.
I heard somebody mention earlier that I think it was you, Keith. You were mentioning the Representative Lucchini that you asked him if you thought the lottery was a tax on the poor.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to take that a little further and kind of give you my perspective on this, that actually most of the poor are actually, uneducated. And so the lottery is really kind of a tax on the uneducated, in my opinion. I mean, if you really knew the odds and the laws of probability, you really have more of a chance of getting shot by an acquaintance or, getting hit by lightning than you really do have a chance of winning that big pot.
Yeah. John, did you want...
Well, we call the first caller, Belinda, and she said she wasn't very smart, but she was smart. She was a smart woman. You could tell she was smart as anybody I know. And she gave her explanation. It was fun. So I hate to have this be posed as the fact that people do this are ignorant. I think that they're desperate. Not necessarily that's the same thing.
Right. David, is that the case, that desperation is different from just sort of being confused and unaware?
Yes, they're absolutely different things. No matter how educated or wealthy you might be, you find that when you hit sort of negative shocks, you start taking greater risk. And it's not because, you become, less intelligent. It's just part of natural, we don't have as much time to focus on that decision, and so we don't put our brain into it.
Diana writes an email from email. I was married to someone with a gambling addiction. I will tell you that the unluckiest and most expensive bet he made was the one that won him $1,100. He spent far more than that amount trying to win big again. And again, it's that once you get the taste and the.
Yeah, I mean, $1,100 seems like a lot of money. It is a lot of money, but it can go pretty fast if you're buying tickets at $10 a day every day.
All right. With that, we're out of time. John, David, thank you both for joining us today. And Representative Lucchini, thank you for joining us as well. John Christie, editor at the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. David Just, professor and director of graduate studies at the Charles H. Dyson School of Applied Economics and Management at Cornell University. Jonathan Woodward ran the board and produced today's program. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our podcasts by visiting mainecalling.net. The executive producer of Maine Calling is Jonathan Smith. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.